there's a gun and a sword crossing one another. Mm-hmm. The boss says something in Italian. We all hold hands. Manatakat, that means you're tying each other's hands. They prick your finger with a sword or with a pin to draw blood. And you go around and meet everybody and you kiss them on the cheek. Now you're a made member.
You are listening to Gangland Wire, hosted by former Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins.
Hello, all you wiretappers out there. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
We are in the 22nd floor of the Plaza Hotel in beautiful downtown Las Vegas, right at the end of Fremont Strip. And don't think you're going to go to sleep in one of these hotel rooms before about 10:30 or 11 o'clock at night, because right off of Fremont Street, they have live bands playing all evening.
Did you hear that last night?
I heard it. Yeah, they shut it down finally.
I finally, when I got in, it was like 1:30 a.m. after we went to the Gandhi movie, and they were really like,
oh, they fired back up. I guess I went to sleep. It was crazy. It was crazy. Well, this is the end of the first day of the Mob World Summit 2018. We had Frank Culotta, yours truly, spoke this morning. We had
J.
Michael Neota, who is an expert on the Southern California Mickey Mouse Mob, although he kind of straightened us out on the Mickey Mouse Mob, didn't he? Mickey Cohen one time, I guess, since Mickey Mouse, they had the Disneyland out there, something to do with Mickey Mouse Cohen or something. But we have another expert on Southern California, and particularly on Jimmy Fradiano. Who else did we have?
Well, just as a note, that J. Michael Neota was the grandson of...
Oh, Jack Dragna.
Jack Dragna.
That's true. I forgot about that.
And then we had the guy from Hot Springs, Arkansas that was...
Yeah, Bob Raines, the Mob Museum of Hot Springs, Arkansas. So if any of you folks are down in Arkansas, or you're traveling down through Arkansas, you might try the Mob Museum of Hot Springs.
Yeah, if you're looking for obviously there's the Mob Museum in Las Vegas, but this one in Hot Springs is really kind of the original one.
Yeah.
The first one, if you will.
Where we're going tonight. The Mob Museum of Las Vegas.
In Las Vegas.
Right, because we're in Las Vegas. Anyhow, we digress. Folks, we have a special guest here tonight, an expert on the Southern California mob, and not this J. Michael Neota, because I want to talk about Jimmy Fradiano. There's a little bit of a Kansas City connection, and we're going to talk about that and a whole lot of other Jimmy Fradiano things. Bob Custer. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you.
We're really glad to have you. Bob is attending the Mob Summit here, so we took this opportunity to grab him rather than doing a telephone interview, we'll just interview you in person.
We're doing a hotel room interview.
Hotel room interview, really. Bob, Jimmy Fradiano, let's just kind of start out in chronological order about him.
Sure.
When he comes from Cleveland, if I remember right, originally. He grew up in Cleveland, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Jimmy was born in 1913 in Naples, Italy.
Oh, he's from Naples. He's not from Sicily, so he...
No, he's from Naples.
I'll be darned.
Yeah. And his family brought him over here, I think, when he was about a year and a half old.
So did they, I suppose they settled into Cleveland early?
Yes, they did.
And did he into probably a Little Italy area?
Yes. And his father worked as a truck driver here.
Okay. So as he became of age, as teenager, and, you know, it's been, as we've done these different mobsters like that of his age, Nick Savella in Kansas City is about the same age. Iupa was about, Chicago was about the same age. Accardo, all these guys that were big in the 70s, the 60s and the 70s, that were running all the action in the United States, they all came up through their parents, who mainly were from the old country, and then they joined some kind of a street gang, and then they started getting in trouble as teenagers. So tell us a little bit about Jimmy Fradiano, or Jimmy the Weasel, as he became known. His early years, is it the same sort of a thing?
Yeah, Jimmy started school, obviously, in Cleveland, and he did get into some trouble when he was like 12 or 13. In fact, his name was mentioned in the Cleveland newspaper at that age.
Oh, really?
Yes, because he was defiant of his teachers, and a teacher had pushed him, and Jimmy said, the teacher assaulted me. And so he was actually in the newspaper. I believe he was about 12 or 13 when that happened. So,
oh, really?
That was kind of the start of his problems as a young man.
Interesting. And I know they used to, back in those days in the 20s, and they would publish things like that of kids,
right,
that it would be illegal today to put a kid's name in a newspaper,
sure,
for getting in trouble, or hardly even put them in as a victim in today. But back then they put them in. We had I was reading an old newspaper article, and this kid was given a second chance. He was brought before a juvenile court judge as a truant, and the judge knew something about his father, and he said, I think I'm going to give you a break. And it gave the kid a break and named the kid. All the other kids were in trouble for truancy. The rest of them all had to go to the boys' home in Kansas,
yeah,
City. So interesting. So Jimmy Fratiano then, kind of what's your memory of his first, like, real crimes?
Well, in his book, he talks a lot about how he got into a little bit of street crime, holding up little poker games, things like that. And he also tried to run his own small casino with his friends there in Cleveland. But it proved more fruitful to go ahead and hold other casinos up than to try to run his own. So, but he did learn the gaming business, quite a bit about it when he was young and in Cleveland in the illegal casinos. So
did he move on in with the Cleveland? They have a Cleveland crime family, and certainly did back then.
Yeah, he was like a connected member.
He came in as an associate, as a young guy.
Yes, an associate, and would do different kinds of street crimes and things like that. Mm-hmm. And eventually he was busted, I think, in 1936. And he was married at the time. He had married his wife, Jewel. And he was busted in 1936. I think he was sentenced to like 8 years in prison.
Was robbery? Armed robbery?
Yes, armed robbery. And they caught him cold-handed, yeah, trying to leave the scene of a crime the police did.
Okay.
But at that point, he'd already had a pretty long career of robbing casinos.
He'd gotten away with
stuff.
Things, yeah. He had been in trouble as a juvenile, minor things, but he really had a full-on criminal career going in his 20s. So that would have been like 1933, 34, 35.
So how much of that time did he do? Do you know?
I believe he got paroled in 1946. So,
so he spent the war.
Quite a bit of time,
He spent the war
he
joint.
He didn't go serve like some of the other maid guys did. But, yeah.
So 1946, that means when he came out, he maybe, is that when he first went to the Los Angeles area?
He didn't go to L.A. right away. He didn't have a bankroll, and his wife had left him. She had divorced him, and he wanted to try to win her back. So he went out and got his bankroll going by doing more stick-ups.
Well, if it works for you, I guess.
Yeah.
Go with what you know.
Exactly. He knew where everything was, so he got involved with different, not just stick-ups, he got involved with safe cracking. He didn't do the safe cracking. He had guys that he knew, guys that could crack the safes. And he built up a nest egg of close to $100,000 from what he said,
wow,
which is like over $1 million today. And he and Jewel remarried, and then he came west to Los Angeles.
Started a new life with his nest egg and
$100,000.
Exactly. Wow.
He said there was too much heat for him in Cleveland, so. Uh-huh. He thought he better move west.
Now, when you say, I have a little question that may not mean all that much. Were they using nitroglycerin? Were they blowing safes, or do you know?
He describes it later on in the book. He says the safe cracker was a guy named Clooney.
Uh-huh.
And Clooney knew how to drill the safe.
Okay.
And he didn't say what he put in there. He put some kind of chemical in there. He said it just went poof, and the safe door opened. He said it was incredible to see.
So he was blowing safes, and
yeah,
like he knew what he put some kind of.
Jimmy himself, Clooney actually did the safe cracking.
Yeah.
But Jimmy was right there, Then he says there was close to $50,000 in that safe, so you can imagine how much money that was back then.
They were able to, like, blow the door without damaging the paper
bills. The
money,
bills. Yeah.
Exactly.
That was real. You never hear blowing a safe anymore.
No.
Or cracking a safe. You just never hear about that. Well, back then, that was a huge deal. I just did a little research with a guy on blowing the safe in the Jackson County Courthouse, which was in Kansas City. It was in Jackson County. And there was a big investigation on some election fraud that the mob was involved with. and they blew the safe. They hired a safecracker who blew the safe to get all the evidence out that was kept locked up. So as I'm researching through this, and I find that there's every major city had these guys who were safecrackers back then, and you just never hear about that anymore. It's a lost art, Aaron.
It's a safe lost cracker. Profession, yeah.
Now they're ATM crackers.
Now they're ATM crackers, exactly. And then they just cable around it and pull it off its hinges. And
they do that thing now with ATMs where they put like a fake front on the ATM and then they get your card information.
It sounds
a lot more easy.
And it's safer.
Safer, yeah. How crime has changed, isn't that interesting?
How was the heat on, you think the heat was on him in Cleveland from the police?
That's what Jimmy said.
Yeah, I mean, here's a guy who's committing crimes, and there had to be a mob family in Cleveland.
Oh, yeah.
You think that they would be like, hey, you can't be doing this without without kicking up. Or
he probably was, wasn't he?
He wanted to leave the area, too.
Yeah. He was probably kicking up, though. He wasn't in trouble with the mob.
And I've read other sources besides his books, of course.
Yeah.
But, no, I think he wanted to move west, too. And somebody had told him, you got to meet Johnny Roselli. He's the guy in Hollywood. He can get you all squared
away. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
So when he got to Hollywood, it took him some period of time. He finally met Roselli, and that got him started to being a made man.
But he probably went out to L.A. and was kind of doing the same...
Same bookmaking.
Oh, bookmaking.
I think he was in the Chase Hotel in Santa Monica. He's got the bookmaking thing going in there. You know, he paid whoever he had to pay and got started. Then he met Jack Dragna and other L.A. made guys. Mm-hmm. And so they introduced him to other guys, and, you know, he got connected that way in L.A.
His friend that was cracking the safes didn't go with him.
Clooney? No, he didn't go with him, I don't think.
But, I had a good career going in Cleveland.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when he gets out there to L.A., he's hooked up with the mob family out there. He probably, somebody vouched for him more than likely.
Johnny Roselli eventually.
In Cleveland, Johnny Roselli probably would have gone back to Chicago and they would have checked with Cleveland. And everything was kosher that he's out there and making book. He's kicking up to Dragna more than likely.
Yes.
Now, where did Mickey Cohen fit into this at the time? We'll digress just a little bit the L.A. family structure and post-World War II Los Angeles area.
Well, Mickey took over when Ben Siegel was murdered. He basically took over some of Siegel's rackets and was running them.
Who was from Cleveland, too, wasn't he? Siegel? Was he?
No, he's from New York City.
He's from New York City, okay.
Yeah. And, so he took over those rackets, and then Dragna hit Cohen up for his 10%, and Mickey said, no way, I'm not paying you. And, you know, Mickey had a crew of his own, some tough guys around him, and so he tried to hold off Dragna, and they tried to hit him probably about 8 times. It's pretty incredible.
So this is a post-World War II mob war in Los Angeles. It was between Mickey Cohen and Jack Dragna.
That's correct. I think Siegel was murdered in June of 1947.
Okay.
So then after that, the real Sunset Wars, like they call them, sometimes got started because Dragna wanted Cohen to pay up, and Cohen said, no, I got my own rackets going from Siegel, you know. Nobody's told me to hand them over to you, and I wouldn't do it anyway, basically. And that started the big war.
So did Fratiano figure into that at all?
Oh, yeah, because Fratiano played both ends against the middle. He acted friendly with Mickey, but he was really on Dragna's side. So that allowed him to try to set Cohen up.
Yeah,
and they did try that a number of times. And Cohen was very lucky, and the L.A. mob was unlucky. So,
interesting.
Well, but Bugsy Siegel was only lucky so long.
Oh, yeah, yeah, he was, yeah, that was...
Before he finally caught a bullet. Right.
Well, you know, Mickey did catch a bullet one time, and then his house was blown up a couple times. So one time the bombing of his home wasn't successful. The next time it was, and he still survived. It blew up the floor underneath his bedroom and everything.
I think it was
12 sticks of dynamite.
Man.
But he survived that. He was shaken, of course.
What year was that?
I believe that was like 1949. Right around then.
All right, so we're getting into 1950.
Yes.
I didn't know they had garage door openers back then.
No, it probably was not a garage
door. No, it was a
remote
fuse.
Control
it was a
device.
Fuse.
It probably lit a fuse, yeah.
In fact, the first time they put the dynamite underneath Cohen's house, they only had one fuse, and Jimmy lit it, and it burned all the way down. And like 2 days later, one of Cohen's henchmen named, I think it was Nettie Herbert, saw the fuse outside Cohen's house, and they followed it to the dynamite.
The dynamite was up under there.
And, you know, the guys hadn't went back and got it. They didn't know what had happened. They weren't going to go back and get it. So yeah. Then like 3 weeks later, I think it was 3 or 4 weeks later, they did the same thing, but they had two fuses. So they lit both fuses, and that one blew.
Crazy.
Why Cohen didn't hire a security guard or somebody to be out there after,
really?
That,
after that first one. Yeah.
Put a lock on that door.
He was really lucky.
He was. What finally happened to Mickey Cohen?
Mickey Cohen got out of prison in 19...
He went to the joint for income tax, I think, didn't he?
Yeah, okay. He went to prison for income tax, and he was finally paroled, I believe, in 1974, and he had been beaten up really badly in prison.
No.
He... actually was paralyzed on one side and was still getting around okay. I think he just died of natural causes the next year in 1975.
Okay. I could remember it. Yeah.
Yeah, I believe he was 64 or something like that.
Well, how does Jimmy Fradiano kind of figure into this as they were trying to... He was playing both sides.
Yes.
So then here he is working for Dragna, in fact.
Yes. Yes, exactly. He was working for Dragna, but... Cohen didn't really realize that. You know, Jimmy had his own little bookmaking thing and kind of worked as protection for Dragna, too. But so, of course, Cohen didn't realize that how tight he really was with Dragna, Jimmy. And so he wasn't that nervous of being around Jimmy. You know, he trusted Jimmy. So Jimmy tried to set him up a number of times.
He probably didn't know he was the one that lit the fuse on that second
set. No, I'm sure he didn't. Yeah. Wow.
We just talked to a guy that's talking about working undercover and the dangerousness of it. That was pretty dangerous for Fradiano because he was, in effect, working undercover on Mickey Cohen.
Just imagine these guys that set these bombs, how nervous they must be. Really? You know, if something goes wrong.
Yeah.
They may have been people that came back from, you know, the war and had some experience with
explosives.
That's true. I mean, you don't know, but did anybody ever figure out who killed
Mickey Cohen?
Oh, eventually he died of natural causes.
Oh, that's right.
Mickey died of natural causes.
Bugsy Siegel, that's who we're thinking of.
They didn't figure that one out.
Well, he was shot with an M1, I believe, and it's a military rifle. But somebody's cooked up some story that Siegel was murdered by his girlfriend's brother and things like that. It was a mob-sanctioned hit. You know, whoever ordered it, we could speculate.
Yeah, and if you remember, in the 1950s particularly, and I'm sure in the 40s, they had those surplus M1 Grands and M1 Carbines all over the place. You could buy them for like $10 or $15.
They were really inexpensive, weren't they?
Yeah. I once knew a guy that rigged his where it could make it fully, put a selector switch on it and make it fully automatic.
Yeah.
Which was pretty easy to do if you knew what you were doing. So we digress on Jimmy Fradiano. So how did he get the name Jimmy the Weasel? Do you know that? Does it go way back?
The story was he was ripping off fruit stands and stuff around Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
And he had made some little score and ran off with the money. And the cop had seen something. And the cop said at the time he ran off like a little weasel. That stuck. People didn't call him that too often to his face, but
probably
he knew
not.
That was his nickname.
Yeah,
I mean, that came up later and more during his life. Anytime there was a hit around L.A. after a few years, his notoriety grew to the point where the L.A. story would say James, you know, the Weasel,
the Weasel Fradiano.
So the public knew his nickname.
Yeah. In this case, lots of times the press will give him the nickname.
Right.
And then everybody else will pick up on it. In this case, the policeman gave him the nickname and probably told some of his friends that day. And so
watch out for that weasel.
We're looking for that weasel. That little weasel ran off like a weasel. I can hear it now. And then the press eventually picked up on it.
And Jimmy was a pretty good athlete. He was quick and strong, and he had boxed as a teenager.
Oh, yeah.
And then his boxing name became Kid Weasel also.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Embraced the nickname for a while.
Maybe not. Maybe this is why he moved to L.A. He was trying to outrun this nickname.
Exactly. Get away from that nickname. So Let's talk about how he got made his bone, shall we say. I became a made man in the killing of the two Tonys. Now, folks, you probably, if you listen to the killing of the two Tonys story that I did, you know some of this story, but let's talk a little bit more about Fratiano's part in that.
Sure. Well, from what he has written, that really wasn't his first murder.
Oh, it wasn't?
No.
But what research I did, you know, who knows it? Nobody really knows how somebody made their bones, but this one author indicated that that's how he made his bones or got his membership in the mob.
That's his most famous murder.
Most famous one, yeah.
Two murders. But two murders, actually, yeah. He talks about how one of Cohen's guys, Dragnick, marked Cohen's guys, you know, for death.
Yeah.
And Jimmy helped carry it out. And they were Cohen's guys that were out on bail. So when they disappeared, Cohen would have to forfeit all the bail money. So I think his first murder was Frankie Nicoli. And that's a guy that trusted him. And Dragnick says, you give that guy one more chance to join us. He's an Italian kid, you know, join us, or you guys got to take him out. And the way Fratiano tells it, they're in his house, which is in Westchester Airport, part of Los Angeles, and they get Frankie Nicoli to come in, and he's out on bail for a Cohen crime, and he talks to him. He says, listen, you got to leave Cohen behind. You got to join Dragnick. You got to help us out. And Nicoli talks to him for a few minutes. He flat out refuses, and then Jimmy had a prearranged signal. Somebody knocks at the door, and it's the other mob guys. He goes, hey, you got to meet this guy. As soon as they come in, they choke the guy to death.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first murder that he's acknowledged. So that was a couple years before the two Tonys killings.
Okay. So then what about the two Tonys then? If I remember right, they came out from Kansas City. That's why I have any interest in it.
Yeah.
They came out from Kansas City. And there were just a couple of knock-around guys in Kansas City. They weren't anybody, but one of them had a relative that got him introduced in out in Los Angeles area.
Yeah, I think Brancato's.
Brancato, I think it was.
His uncle.
His
was
uncle.
Connected.
Okay.
Yeah, and helped them get started out here. But they had been arrested in Kansas City a number of times,
yeah,
from what I've read.
Yeah, they were, but did, like small stuff. They were.
Well, I think armed robbery and.
Well, I guess by small stuff, they weren't really. You know,
shooting anybody yet?
Connected guys, yeah, with the outfit or the family in Kansas City.
Right.
Well, but they were working kind of separately in Kansas City, right? They weren't like paired up working in Kansas City like they were in L.A.
I think they knew each other.
They knew. Kansas City. Oh yeah, they had know each other. Yeah, yeah, they didn't just meet in L.A. They came out
they
together. From
they were
Kansas
kind of famous.
City. Yeah.
When they got out here, not yeah. famous, notorious maybe. The police were already watching them. From
so,
what I've read.
Yeah. Okay. So they come out, and what do they do that attracts the attention of Jack Dragnick and Jimmy Fratiano?
Well, they make a really big mistake, and we're probably sitting, 3.5 miles from where they made the mistake. They held up the Flamingo Hilton, which everybody knows was Benjamin Siegel's Bugsy's place,
yeah,
which everybody knew was a mob-connected place. They held up the sports book there, and the sports book manager's name was High Goldbaum. He had run a book in Beverly Hills like a year before that had been held up by the same two guys, at least
so
by
he
one
knew
of
him.
Them. Well, one of the guys, their mask fell off, and he recognized Brancato. He goes, not you again. So when they reported the crime, you know, the FBI and everybody got involved. They weren't going to, like, let the mob look for these guys. They could be anywhere. So Brancato made the FBI's most wanted list. For holding up
the Flamingo.
Yeah.
Wow.
He was on there like a week, and then they found him.
Yeah.
So.
Right. They found him alive, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They found him in San Francisco. Yeah.
They absolutely charged him and let him out.
They charged him.
Bail when this.
He was going to exit the jail in San Francisco on bail. That's kind of interesting. And he was rearrested again on another Nevada warrant. Well, then. He was back in jail, and his attorney filed one of those writs of habeas corpus.
Yeah.
And so he was released again. And then he came down to Los Angeles and saw Tromino, and they were still partners. But
they were the two
Tonys. They restarted more criminal activity.
I was just recollecting from our conversations when we had done an episode about the two Tonys, if they were really, they weren't known as the two Tonys in Kansas City so much as when they were out in Los Angeles.
I don't think so.
I'd say that's true.
I don't really know that much about what they did in Kansas City.
Yeah.
They knew each other.
They knew each other, yeah. They're a few years apart, but...
So he's back down in Los Angeles, and the two Tonys are hooked up, and they've done this robbery of the Flamingo.
Yeah.
And they've got to go.
Well, they're pulling scams. Like, one of the scams they pulled, they went to a gambler, a well-to-do guy named Sam Lazus.
Uh-huh.
And Sam owed the syndicate like $3,000, and he had a lot of money. These two guys said, we're the collectors for the syndicate, and he kind of vaguely recognized them. They hustled him out of the $3,000. You know, that's probably like over $30,000 now.
Really?
Then the syndicate guy showed up, and he said, I already gave the other guys the money.
Uh-oh.
So then this all got back to Dragna, and Dragna, you know, told Jimmy, we've gotten so many bad reports about these guys. I think we have to clip them. And he says, set them up.
Okay.
I guess from the way Jimmy described, Dragna gave him the orders in a very calm voice, no emotion, just, I've gotten bad reports, and I think we got to clip them.
Was there ever any word about did they have to ask anybody's permission to hit these guys?
That's a good question. I don't know.
I never remember reading anything about that, but
if Jack Dragna had to ask anybody, I think each family, from what I've read, in their own territory could, because those guys, remember, were not made guys.
Yeah, that's true.
They were made guys. It would have been different, I think. But you know, they're out here from Kansas City, and they were causing like.
Trouble.
Remember during the seminars earlier, too much heat.
Yeah.
They don't want that heat.
Way too much heat. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Did you say Nick Civella said
Nick
that?
Civella
don't cause the heat.
Don't
you know?
Bring that heat
on. And
they
were bringing heat. You know, they're robbing Vegas. They were robbing around Hollywood.
When they rob a sports book in Beverly Hills, that wasn't like some legitimate sports book.
Right.
That was some mobster's sports book.
Exactly, Aaron. That's true. So now here's
Dragna being the boss of L.A., he can order a hit like that without... calling
back.
Because they weren't made guys in Kansas City that came out.
Absolutely.
Okay, all
right. Right. If they were made guys, he'd have to.
Right, he would have had to.
And in fact, the boss back there would tell these two, the two Tonys, to cool it.
Yeah.
You know, you guys are doing the wrong thing.
First of all, then if they kept it up after that, then he might give him permission.
Right.
So how did Jimmy the Weasel, Fratiano, was given this order to do that? How did he go about getting them set up? Because they had to be a little bit nervous about being around somebody like Fratiano, I would think.
They were, from what he says. And it's pretty interesting because he thought of a plan to convince them that there was a high-stakes poker game that they could hold up. But he had to figure out a reason to talk to them about all this. So he told Lazus to tell them, hey, you know, I want to meet with these guys, but don't tell them it's me that'll be there. I'll just kind of show up at the meeting, that kind of thing. So between another friend named Sam London, who lived at the Ogden Street apartment, Fratiano met them there on Ogden Street in Hollywood and talked to him. At first they were leery because they knew him and thinking, what does this guy want to talk to us about? But he said he wore his shirt untucked so they could see he didn't have a gun or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And he told them about this poker game, which of course did not exist. And it took a few minutes. He convinced them that, yeah, we can get this poker game. And they asked him, why aren't you going to hold it up? He goes, I'm not in that racket anymore. He goes, I'll bring the tools. I'll bring another guy to help. And I get a full cut. And he told them there might be $40,000 in this game. And they said, great, let's do it. He said, you know, meet me here at 7 o'clock tonight outside the apartment.
Wow. So they... they went someplace. If I remember right, I'm trying to remember. They went someplace like, we're going to go in here and do this. But Fratiano got in the car with him.
Yeah, he didn't get in the car with him then, though. He went back to, it was Nick Licata's restaurant in Burbank, California. It's called the 5 O'Clock Club. And that was their alibi. They said, we're going to stage, we're having a big fish fry for all our friends. And they talked over the whole plan there, and Jimmy said, I really probably shouldn't kill them because a lot of people saw me at the apartment talking to them earlier today. And Dragna said, who else we got, Jimmy? And one of the other guys said, if they see somebody else there, they're probably going to drive off. It won't work. So Jimmy realized he had to do it, and if he didn't do it, obviously Dragna would have him killed. So they went back to the Ogden... Right outside the Ogden Street apartment, he and Charlie Batts, and they waited for the two Tonys to return about 7 p.m.
Okay. So there's the famous photos. I'm sure you've seen those photos of the two Tonys in the car. They're both sitting, one in the driver's seat and one in the passenger seat.
That's right.
And some of the windows, glass is blown out, but the shots came from inside, if I remember right.
They did.
How did that go down?
Well, from what I've been able to determine, Jimmy and Charlie Betts, there's an alley right behind the apartments on Ogden. They kind of stood back at an angle. When they saw the car pull up, they just walked out to the car, and Jimmy opened the door. Charlie Betts slid in, Jimmy slid in, and they started a blast right away. Of course, Jimmy now, you know, in his book, he said that Charlie Betts was so nervous he couldn't even pull his gun until Jimmy had shot both guys. So,
oh, really? So he takes credit for both?
Both of them, yeah. So, but so then they got out of the car. They had it set up with a getaway car and a crash car if anybody tried to follow their getaway car. They got away cleanly and were arrested the next morning.
I've seen that picture where Fratiano was brought in the next day by the LAPD.
Right. And they grilled him, you know, but everybody kept their mouths shut. Even the two Sams, the guys outside the outfit, I'm surprised they never said anything. Sam Lazis and Sam London never.
Because they knew. This
they knew Fratiano had to have done it.
Yeah.
Well, it turned out Fratiano, he brought the associate that he said he was going to, and he brought tools, just not the ones they were expecting.
Exactly. That was Charlie Batts.
And odds are, do you think that Dragna paid him to do that job then? Or he
no,
just had to do
not,
it
not from
bones?
Everything you know, I've researched. Mob guys are never paid for hits.
Yeah, that's been my experience. Everything I've read about it. If you're a mob guy and you go out and do a hit, there's no such thing as like a paid mob hitman. You
no.
just do it as a
That's
favor.
That's like a myth kind of
yeah.
thing.
Yeah, well, just do it so as a favor.
It seems odd to me that the two Tonys wouldn't be smart enough to know that maybe one of them should have been in the back seat.
Really, I thought about that too. They just trusted Fratiano. I guess
not
he was
the sharpest
good at that.
Tools in the toolbox.
No.
Maybe.
Right. What if one was sitting in the back seat when they pulled up? And Jimmy and Charlie Batts came over. They couldn't have shot him, obviously.
Yeah.
Well, maybe, but it'd be a lot tougher.
It would have gone down a little different because now one would be in the front seat and the other guy behind him in the other seat. You know, but that seems like, you know, we've done a number of episodes and it always, you know, it's like somebody they trust, somebody they know, and then they get in the vehicle and the guy's in the back seat.
He didn't know them really well, but they were greedy and everything. Yeah. And they got very careless.
Well, it's like Frank Culotta said this morning, it's always going to be somebody that you know.
Yeah.
That's who's going to get you.
Exactly.
Not somebody you don't know.
Well, like when Frank was involved in the hit here in town, he wasn't paid any money for it.
Yeah.
As far as everything I've read.
Yeah, he just had to do it because Tony told him to.
Because Tony told him
if
to.
If you're going
to
be part of it, you're going to do that. Yeah. That's for sure. So Fratiano, of course, he skates out of that. Trying to remember, didn't LAPD during this time in the 50s, didn't they have some kind of a mob squad that was notorious for whacking these guys around?
Oh, the gangster squad?
Yeah, the gangster squad. Kind of the confidential, LA confidential movie.
Exactly. They had a real crew like that. They weren't too worried about the Constitution or anything like that.
Yeah.
They just... to them, the Constitution was a ship. That was it. You know,
USS Constitution.
But finally, L.A. had a reform police chief, Parker.
Parker, now remember
and he formed
he
the gangster squad, and he had some tough guys running it.
Yeah,
they basically, you know, to the mob guys, we're going to just follow you guys till we drive you crazy. Mm-hmm. And to a certain extent, it helped. I think
they beat the crap out of a few people too.
Yeah,
threw them off of the Mulholland Falls.
Yeah, I know.
Drive, according to one movie that they did with Nick Nolte about it, and it probably is some truth to that.
It's, you know, it was so different back then.
Yeah,
you know, in terms of, you know, there was no monitors or anything inside jails or prisons. You know, camera monitors. There was nothing.
So oh yeah, you'd get away with a lot before
the
cell phone cameras. Believe me, I know.
Absolutely.
Cops didn't look like Kevin Spacey necessarily.
No, no, I don't think so. That's a pretty well-formed character, but yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, it was a good story.
Yeah, it was.
L.A. Confidential. But so moving on forward with Jimmy the Weasel, he is now moving on up in the mob, in the L.A. mob.
And yes.
He forms other relationships. You mentioned something about his relationship with Bompazzario in San Diego. Well, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Jimmy and Bomp became close friends pretty quickly. When Jimmy got out here, I think Bomp, I'm not sure if he was on the lam right then, but they became good friends, and they worked on different, not just hits together, but different bookmaking enterprises. And then Bompazzario had a bar in San Diego that Jimmy knew a lot about, and they would just talk business a lot together. So they really were good friends until Bompazzario was killed in 1977.
So, Fratiano, during the 60s on up into the 70s, what kind of action is he kind of moved up and got had more sophisticated action? What did he get involved in?
Well, if we go back to a little bit farther back in his career, in the early 50s, after the two Tonys hit, he was a made guy right after that. Then a year later, he was made a capo by Jack Dragna.
Ah.
So he became a capo at that point. Then a year after that, he made a call to somebody that owed him money, and he threatened their lives. And he got 6.5 years in prison for extortion. So from 54 to 1960-ish, he was in prison. So
was he running a book then?
Had yes.
Gamblers owe him money?
He was trying to... Oh, this was a outside mob deal. This was... He had given investment money to a couple guys that owned liquor stores to put into oil wells.
Oh, okay.
And these guys, they had like a 2% share of these oil wells. Well, there's a story in the LA Times that said these oil wells might return $10 million.
Yeah.
And Jimmy realized his share would be several hundred thousand. And then all of a sudden they tried to return the investment money, this oil company. So, and Jimmy writes in the book how his hands were tied in dealing with people outside the mob. You know, he should have known you can't threaten them.
I see.
Remember in Casino, he even tells Nicky, the guy's going to run to the FBI.
Yeah.
And that's just what happened.
Yeah.
These guys ran to the FBI, and then they taped him threatening them some more. And I'm going to blow your head off, and they'll never catch me, and things like that on tape.
Right.
So 6.5 years. I think that chapter in his book is called The 6.5 Year Phone Call.
No. Interesting. Yeah, they... that's why they extort money from these people when these kind of gray market areas like porn shops and
right.
strip clubs. And,
that's very
and,
true.
And cocaine dealers, you know, they'll invest money in people like that.
Right. They go after illegal businesses or
quasi-illegal fringe businesses because they figure they won't go to the cops and they got some hold over them and they can intimidate them.
Exactly.
But you're Square John businessman, you want to be real careful when you do that, don't you?
Right. And Jimmy learned that the hard way.
Six and a half year phone call. That's
six
a good
and a
way.
Half year phone call.
So he does that stretch and he comes out. I'm looking on Wikipedia and they basically say he went back to Chicago.
Well, he transferred to Chicago.
Transferred.
What's interesting about the mob, I know it's
transfer your membership. It's like transferring.
He transferred, he got out. And when he got out of prison, he had left $100,000 on the street in Shylock money. That's money he could loan out to people, obviously, and they pay him back at a high interest rate. He left it with the other mob guys, and he got out, and he says, okay, how's my money? Oh, the money's all gone, Jimmy.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
So I'm surprised. I don't understand enough about it, why he didn't try to go after these guys himself. Maybe because they were made guys, too. So the money's all gone, and... then he thought they were trying to get him in trouble, so he talked to Roselli. He says, I need to transfer to Chicago. He gives Roselli like a 10-minute impassioned speech.
Uh-huh.
And so they transfer him to Chicago, but he can still live out here. That's one thing that's kind of interesting about the mob. You don't have to live where your family is, you know what I mean?
So he was under the authority of the Chicago
That's
outfit,
correct. Giancana was his boss
in
then.
L.A.
Right.
So was he close to Giancana then? Did he get close to him?
He writes about several meetings with him.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. He said he likes Sam. You know, he's a good guy, a stand-up guy and all that.
How did that work then? He had to kick up to somebody in Chicago for any action that he...
Right.
could get going. What kind of stuff did he get? Did he go back into bookmaking?
Bookmaking.
Then he went back into
bookmaking. He takes sports bets and horse racing bets.
He probably had some sub agents working for him.
Yeah, exactly. Him. Have runners and collectors, and you know, they get great big guys to go help collect the money.
Yeah.
If somebody's slow to pay,
probably get back into some shylocking.
Yeah,
with the
exactly.
Gamblers, because they end up with these kind of gray area of poor businessmen who gamble too, and so then those guys need money for something else.
Right, they need exactly.
Yeah, there's no payday loans back in the.
Yeah, no, these were the payday loans.
Jimmy tells a funny story too. They thought of, we're trying to think of ways to make money. He and it just his. Connected buddies in San Francisco that made some guy humanitarian of the year, an old friend of Mickey Cohen's named Benny Barish. And so they sent up like humanitarian of the year banquet, and it was just it was really like a scam. Everybody was this Benny Barish guy. He did do things for kids and all that in San Francisco, but he was a former boxer and friend of Cohen's. They had like a humanitarian awards thing for him. And they just cut up the extra money. They charge like 20 a plate. Well, they figure each plate of food back going to be $5 or $6. The extra money, these guys, four guys, just cut it up. So, he was always thinking of things like that, though, to make money.
Was he still married to the woman he moved from Cleveland with? No.
They were married a long time. They got remarried, and then Jimmy was quite a womanizer. In the mid-60s, he writes about how Jewel started to drink too much. And he was chasing other women. And they, when he went into prison again, he got busted on a parole violation. He was in prison again in Chino. He found out Jewel was maybe having a boyfriend or maybe. You know what I mean. And he got upset. They ended up getting divorced. Mm. But they had a trucking business going at one point that was quite successful.
And she was running that when he was in the slammer?
He was kind of... It's a little sketchy on that part of his life because he doesn't write about that much in the book. And I've tried to research it using FBI Freedom of Information assets and things like that. It just seemed to me he was always on the verge of getting violated for parole. And then he started the trucking business and he was doing better. But then the trucking business got into trouble. He was involved in something in El Centro, California, and his business then was making $1 million a year. Which is like $6 million a year now. It was a big trucking company.
That was a trucking company. Wow.
And they violated the Public Utility Commission coding for kind of Mickey Mouse stuff that they weren't paying the drivers quite enough. And they got busted in El Centro. And they got jailed and everything, of course. And Bomp got busted too because Bomp was helping him in this trucking business.
So he invested in the trucking business and
Bomp
worked with
didn't invest.
He just.
Actually, Jimmy got. That's a great question. Jimmy got a lot of the money from a. Mayor Alioto, Joe Alioto, the famous mayor of San Francisco.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he ran the bank where Jimmy got a total loans totaling about $200,000. So pretty big loans, and that helped him grow the business. But Jimmy knew the trucking business because his dad had been a trucker.
Back in Cleveland.
Yeah.
Which kind of makes this other story that I mentioned earlier to you make sense, that he was connected with Jackie Presser, the Teamsters
yes.
Union. Probably through his father, and because Jackie Presser's father was involved with the Teamsters Union.
Right.
Going back would be a peer of Fratiano's father. Interesting how these little connections work.
Exactly. Somebody knows somebody else.
Yeah. So they kind of trust each other because, you know, and I'll tell you guys what the story was. We talked about this earlier. I just saw this in the Mike Burns Chicago Outfit article, old and new news articles. There's a news article about Fratiano. Tried to start a dental plan with the Teamsters Union where every Teamster would have dental coverage. And so it was like an insurance company almost. And
yes.
they would come up, that they would get the money from the Teamsters Union and hire the dentist or hire a company that would then manage the dental plan. And Fratiano would get a piece of it. And,
right.
And Jackie Presser would get a piece of it kind of under the boards.
And the dentist would be
off
giving
the books,
kickbacks.
And the dentist would give kickbacks. And even dentists right. would want to be part of it. And he wanted to do that, but he had to get permission from Chicago to do that because Chicago, really, when it comes to doing anything with the Teamsters, they were the big duck.
Right.
Because they had the right. connection to Alan Dorfman. And then Kansas City, of course, had the connection with Roy Lee Williams, who ends up being the international president.
He did.
Late in his life, after Fitzsimmons, I guess. He was the next one after
Frank
Fitzsimmons.
Fitzsimmons, I
think. Frank Fitzsimmons. And when Fratiano took this plan to IUPA, he said, no, he said, if we knew anything like that, we'd do it with Nick Savella and Roy Williams down in Kansas City. And they tried to get something going down here, and it by the time it ever came to fruition, that's when the FBI was all over them, Chicago, Cleveland, and because of the skim and the borrowed money from the Teamsters Pension Union. So kind of a small world there.
Yeah, it's amazing. The connections between the different families and the different scams they had going. And
so Fratiano, now we're getting on up. He's been in and out of the joint. He's got these businesses going. He's done well. He's done not so well. He's done well.
Yeah.
And he ends up in a huge amount of trouble when he goes into witness protection program. What caused that? What happened?
Well, the thing was that he revealed so many mob secrets in his book.
Yeah.
And then he testified against different mob bosses.
What did the government have on him that caused him
to turn? Oh, the main thing that turned Jimmy was the fact he figured out the mob guys were, there was a hit on him. There was a contract on him. And he had enough evidence. He saw enough things going on around him. For example, his boss, Dominic Berkleyer, would not return his phone calls.
Nah.
He couldn't get a hold of him. He even called Dominic Berkleyer's son, Anthony, who went on to a long career as a famous L.A. defense attorney.
I was going to say, I knew that name.
Yeah, he's very famous. He defended a lot of well-known people, including musician Rick James and Hollywood madam Heidi Fleiss.
Oh, really?
Yeah, a lot of celebrities. And also his dad. He defended his dad. But he called Anthony Berkleyer and said, I got to talk to your dad. And he kind of just said, my dad will be in touch with you. And Jimmy knew the Berkleyers very well. In fact, he was godfather to one of Dominic Berkleyer's other sons. But he could tell he was being frozen out. And the FBI was telling him, hey, we saw another mob guy outside your house. And Jimmy said, hey, the guy told me he was in L.A. I said, no, he's right here in San Francisco. He's been watching your house. So they... Plus, two of his close mob friends had been killed. You know, Johnny Roselli had been killed, and Frank Pompanciero had been killed.
Oh, interesting.
So, two of your oldest friends get killed, and you figure, I'm next. I'm on the hit parade.
Yeah.
I was looking at the Wikipedia, and it said that Dragna approached him about killing Bronserio.
Pompanciero?
Oh, no. Dragna was dead by then.
Maybe that's not why it's not right.
Berkleyer approached him. Yeah. Berkleyer... Jimmy didn't like the idea, but he realized then that Bomp was talking to the FBI. But he stalled around because Berkleyer went into prison, and then Jimmy was a co-acting boss with Louis Tom Dragna. Okay. And he kind of stalled around because Jimmy knew he was the only one that could probably kill Bomp and Sierra. But he thought, maybe we can fix this. So they talked everything over, and then Dragna had the idea. Louis Tom Dragna said, look, we'll just have, we're going to give Bompanciero a promotion. When he gets that promotion, he'll be all calm. He won't be nervous. So they made him consigliere of the LA family. And it did, Jimmy said it did calm him down, Bomp. He wasn't so angry about everything, but it relaxed him, and he dropped his guard. But Jimmy said, I never thought about killing him myself. You know, he said, if Berkleyer survives his prison term, they can worry about it later. Yeah. But I'm not going to do it.
Huh. Think that's some of the reason he fell out of favor? Because he wouldn't...
Jimmy?
Yeah.
You know, he speculates on those things. But he knew those guys didn't like him anyway, you know? He knew that Berkleyer and the other newer guys in the L.A. family didn't like him very much. His only friend in the newer L.A. mob members was Mike Rizzitello. Mike Rizzitello and Jimmy were pretty close friends.
So Chicago couldn't protect him anymore, it sounds like.
Well, from what he wrote, he knew he had to handle it himself. He could kill the guys in the mob out here that were trying to kill him, but you know, that's hard to do. Remember, he was like 62 years old at the time. And of course, they were older guys too, but still. He tried to get the Mexican mafia to help protect him. And he was in the middle of that. The Mexican mafia, from what he wrote, was going to help him try to hit the L.A. guys who were trying to hit Jimmy. But then in the meantime, the FBI flipped him. Because they came to him and said, hey, we can't watch you all the time. You know, they laid on kind of thick.
Yeah.
We can't watch you all the time, Jimmy. But he was right outside your house here. Did he tell you he was going to be here? Yeah. And Jimmy knew they were telling him the truth.
Yeah.
They had the recordings and stuff.
Had him talking bad about him.
Yeah.
Bad mouthing him, yeah.
This is one of those kind of like...
That's how they turned Frank Culotta.
Yeah, the Frank Culotta moment where they play back a tape and people that Frank knows and they're telling, is it Tony Spilotro, that he needs to clean his dirty laundry.
Yeah.
Aaron used to work, well, he still works at the same place, but this guy that started this restaurant, a guy named Jimmy DiCapo, they called him Chubby, started this restaurant named Chubby's, and he was a bookie also. They came, the Bureau approached him. They put him in the joint for failing to testify. Mm-hmm. Gave him immunity and put him in for failing to testify. And Bureau had a tape of him bad-mouthing him. And saying, you know, they're a little nervous about him. And would he hold up? Because he was, he had an Italian last name, but he was only half Italian. And they were really worried about whether he'd hold up or not. And they approached him, but he wouldn't do it. And you know, he was right. They didn't do anything to him. He came out of his little stint. But that's a pretty common tactic among the FBI. You get any kind of conversation, and you can then add a little of your own ingenuity spin on it and go to these guys and say, you know, they're going to kill you. You might as well come on in.
Yeah, it was interesting what Frank Culotta said to Dave. Remember the former police officer that was in the Hole in the Wall gang?
Yeah.
Frank Blasco. Said, I don't like working with former cops on crime, you know. Blasco, yeah.
Joe Blasco. Yeah, that guy, he was actually even in their intelligence unit, and he was feeding stuff to Tony Spilotro all along, and then he got caught. They changed up. The old sheriff went out. The new sheriff, McCarthy, came in, and he started cleaning house, and they also combined the Metro and the County PD with the Metro, Clark County with the Metro PD, and created this new intelligence unit, and it came out about Blasco, and they fired him. He was actually had been fired when he, or he probably quit before he got fired when he was working with the Hole in the Wall gang. But he had done that kind of stuff as a cop. There's an organization called LEIU, Law Enforcement Intelligence Units, and Las Vegas had been kicked out of that because of Joe Blasco. That was the FBI told the other police departments that were involved with LEIU as a national organization that, hey, they got a bad egg down there in L.A., and they weren't admitting to it, so they just booted them out. And then after Joe McCarthy, or was it Joe McCarthy? Not Joe McCarthy. I can't think of his first name.
Is it Kevin? No.
Might have been. But his name was – no, that's another actor or something. But McCarthy, after he took over, and he installed Kent Clifford as the new
– Kent Clifford.
Kent Clifford as the new – what's his first name?
Oh, I said Charlie McCarthy.
Charlie McCarthy. No, it's not Charlie either. But they'd kick Blasco out, and they got back in LEIU, and they started working with the FBI real closely. Matter of fact, that was a combined task force that night with LAPD, Nevada Metro PD intelligence guys and the FBI that did that whole, when they captured the Hole in the Wall and the gang that night. And they were pretty happy to take Joe Blasco off. He did a little time. He came back out, and he's died since then. I was going to try to find him and try to get an interview out of him, but he was died.
I think he died in 05. He got out, I know he worked as a bartender at the Crazy Horse 2, the Exotic Dance Place.
Oh, God, and that was owned by a...
He must have had some stories. Huh?
Yeah, he would have had some great stories, wouldn't he?
Yeah, he would have.
So we digress off of Jimmy Fradiano. He's gone into witness protection program.
Yeah.
They used him as a traveling whore, basically.
Yeah,
go all over
did.
The country to testify about mob guys. What did you start to say when we talk about
sorry. What? I'm just looking at the Wikipedia about him, and it says he kind of... he was implicated by Ray Ferrito in the murder of Danny Green.
Yes.
I forgot about that story.
According to Wikipedia, I'm just looking at this as we're talking, and it sounds like this is part of what kind of drove him into witness protection.
Yeah, that he had knowledge they were going to try to kill Danny Green.
He was an old Cleveland guy.
Yeah, he was an old Cleveland guy. Tony Dope Delisanter was Jimmy's buddy in Cleveland.
Okay.
And Tony Dope told him, we have a great plan to take out Danny Green. He said, we put the bomb in the car next to his car.
Yeah.
So he doesn't suspect anything, you know. So he parked his car somewhere, and Ray Ferrito drove the bomb car next to where Danny Green's car was. And when Danny Green came out from his doctor's appointment, they ignited the bomb. And it, you know, almost cut him in half, yeah, part of him. Anyway.
Wow.
Well, they had been trying to kill Danny Green for some time.
He was like a Mickey Cohen back there. He just... Hey, seven or eight attempts, I think. It was a lot of times they tried to. And, of course, Ferrito turned state's evidence a year or two later. He did a few years in prison. I think he passed away a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But Jimmy the Fratiano, so he goes into witness, witness protection, and then they kick him out?
Yeah, that's down the road. They did kick him out, I believe it was 1990. Couple years before then, he had written a book, Vengeance is Mine. He didn't use Ovid Damaris with this book. He used a guy named Michael Zuckerman. And he wrote that book, and it did pretty well on the book sales charts. And the next thing he knows, the FBI is saying, you got enough money now. You don't need us anymore.
Mm.
And we don't need you.
Yeah, and the FBI, some of the guys that helped turn him said, that's not how it's supposed to work. And one of the people said, oh, this isn't supposed to be a retirement plan for Hoods. But like he said, he had $100,000 in cash, maybe. It's hard to hide out for very long.
Yeah.
And his second wife was with him, Jean, and he didn't have that much money, mm-hmm. you know. And they kicked him out. And I think it was Jim Ahern, the FBI guy, said, the whole problem is you kick Fratiano out, how do you flip other guys down the road? They're going to say, look what you did to Jimmy Fratiano. Yeah. They didn't win every case. He gave testimony. He kind of outed a lot of mob guys. And the ones that weren't found guilty were outed or whatever. They're, you know.
Well, how many years was he doing working for the government then?
Six, at that point, 10, like 12 years,
12
I think.
Years.
Almost 12 years.
Yeah. What they do is that when they have a big RICO mob trial, mafia, they can bring a guy like Fratiano in, or Ken Ito did this too,
mm-hmm.
and they can say, okay, tell us about this mafia thing. Tell us about this organization. You're
right.
Going to say, okay, you know, my experience is that Joey Iupa is the boss.
Right.
And Jackie Cerrone is, you know, this crew leader, or he's an underboss, and this guy, and this guy is that guy, and they're all they're the defendants.
Exactly.
So then the jury gets to hear that this is an organization, because they're trying to do the racketeer influence and corrupt organization charge. So that's where Fratiano, because he spoke as an expert, and they used him all around the United States in different cases.
It's not enough that the cops... the feds say, this is what this organization is.
Here's anybody could say
here's
that.
Our evidence of that. And
right.
They're like, well, we need to bring this other guy in who used to kill people and run rackets for the mob.
Right.
Yeah. He's going to tell everybody in the courtroom.
And he had met with IOPA and stuff. He had met with a lot of those guys.
Yeah.
He knew things about them. The FBI had him surveilled when he met with certain people, or, you know, either on the phone or... in some conference room, whatever, they see him go in. You know, see him leave.
Yeah,
they had
proof to show that, he does know.
Proof, yeah, that Jimmy knew those guys.
Yeah.
He was down in front
neck. I mean, you can't
neck.
Say he didn't know Frank Sinatra.
Oh.
You know, the famous mob shot of Frank Sinatra and
Jimmy
and Carlo Gambino.
Yeah.
And he's got his arms around Greg De Palma. Sinatra does. And Sinatra said later on, oh, they kind of just rushed me in the dressing room.
Yeah.
They rushed me. Well, why does he have his arms around them? Come on.
Yeah.
So they knew that Jimmy knew these people.
And why did Frank Sinatra, at the zenith of his career, get Dean Martin and somebody else to go play the Vesuvius Room up in Chicago? What was the name of that room they played? It was like a, you know, like a kind of a local dance club almost.
Yeah.
and they all went up and played that room. And it was filled with Chicago mob
who
guys.
Who owned it? Yeah. IOPA or?
You know, I can't remember. It wasn't IOPA, but IOPA. It was somebody that was connected. So, yeah, they...
I was just curious. Jimmy didn't go down to Frontenac, Kansas to hunt doves.
I didn't go hunt doves at Frontenac. It's just because he wasn't a dove hunter. But
because, you know, yeah. the whole...
Joey
the
Doves.
Joey Doves, story.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
That's a good story.
Yeah, it was.
Well, so all these years, then they kick him out.
Yes.
Now he's kind of back out on the street, you know, having to make a living from a couple of books.
Yeah, he had some money from the books, and they paid his living expenses, of course, and he had a car, and his wife had a car. But he'd put money, from what I read, he put money into a relative's car lot. That lost some of his money. So he was getting Social Security, but it's not enough money to hide on, really.
Yeah.
And he had a fake ID and everything. I did find out later on he relocated to the city of Oklahoma, and he was living there when he died in 1993.
Oh, in Oklahoma City?
Bethany, Oklahoma.
Oh, Bethany, Oklahoma. I didn't realize that, huh?
And his widow is still there, from what I'm able to
determine. Oh, really?
I'd sure like to talk to her.
What's her name?
Her name's Jean.
Huh. Jean Frodiano.
She's got
she's quite a bit younger than
Jean. Well, she was a lot younger when...
Jean is... I think she's about 75 now.
Okay, huh.
So, you know, she was... there's some old photographs of Jimmy when he first started to go out with her. She was like 21, and Jimmy was, I don't know, late 50s or something. Maybe
oh, really?
Late 50s, yeah. Well, he had to be quite the charmer, I'm sure.
Well, he looked like it. He was a snappy dresser.
He loved to dress sharp.
He was a snappy dresser. Those
guys, got to give him credit for that. They dress sharp.
Yeah. His FBI agent, Kansas City Bill Owsley, says, you know, he said, here's what happened to the mob. He said they started wearing tracksuits. He said back in the day they'd wear, you know, $1,000 suits. You know, maybe $100 suits, but it would be equivalent to $1,000 today. They would, you know, $500 suits. They would wear these nice suits. Everybody dressed nice. And I know there was almost like a dress code, and we talked about this before in Kansas City. You know, you dressed normal and decent. And he said, now these dudes, young dudes, want to wear track suits and big chains around their neck. And
yeah, it's like wearing a sign, huh?
Yeah.
When they're in a nice business suit, they look like businessmen.
Yes.
When they're standing out in front of their social club in a tracksuit,
yeah,
not jogging.
I know you see those surveillance photos. It's they look so disheveled sometimes. Yeah. It's like, jeez.
Unless you're trying to do a deal like the Chin Gigante,
the Chin, oh, act crazy,
act yeah. crazy, wear your bathrobe everywhere and talk to yourself.
Yeah,
didn't work for him in the end, though.
Well, no, so, it didn't.
Jimmy Frodiano here on Wikipedia died in 1993, and he died in Oklahoma. And there was an autopsy that was performed. It says that it said that he died from complications due to Alzheimer's.
Yes.
Oh, Alzheimer's. Wow.
And he forgot everything. Yeah, that's what I understand.
Huh.
Good thing he got those books done before it kicked
in. Yeah, really.
Here's an interesting story. We had a mob guy in Kansas City, a guy named Jimmy Duarte. He was an old school kind of a mob guy all the way up till the 80s. He took a hit for... bombing, actually organizing and orchestrating the bombing of a nightclub, which is probably an insurance job. And he came back out, and he was getting ready to go in a nursing home, and they had an estate sale, had a sale of everything in the house because he was downsizing, going into a nursing home. I think his wife was deceased by then. So one of the guys from the intelligence unit heard about it, and he went into the, you know, you could just walk in through the house, and they had stickers on everything that
yeah.
there was for sale. And so he walked through there, and he found a copy of Frodiano's book, The Last Mafioso. And then he opened it up. He bought it. I don't know whatever happened to this guy. Died not too few years later. And there was, like, notes in the margin about, well, this didn't happen. And,
oh, yeah.
And different kind of notes like that.
So well, Jimmy admitted he lied probably 150 times, so lied or exaggerated. He said that in a deposition in court.
Yeah.
So.
God, I'd like to get a copy of that copy of that book that Duarte marked up, although his daughter claims, his daughter got hold of me and claims that that wasn't her dad that did that, that had to be her mom.
Oh, really?
So who knows?
Well, here on the Wikipedia, there's a list of the number of folks that, Jimmy the Weasel, or if he was alive in the 2000s, Jimmy the Weasel.
Weasel.
Yeah, you know, Pauly Shore.
Oh, yeah.
But included in that list was Frank Nicoli.
Frankie Nicoli,
Frankie
yeah.
Nicoli. And Frank Borgia.
Frank Borgia.
Borgia. Yeah.
I think that's how you say it.
Anthony Abricato.
Bricado.
Bricado, the two Tonys. Anthony Trumbino, the other Tony.
Yeah, Tony.
and Louis Strauss.
Russian Louis. That was a Vegas case, actually.
Oh, really?
You know, Russian Louis had some extortion information on Benny Binion, right over here, Binion's Horseshoe.
Yeah.
And I guess the procedure is, because Binion wasn't a made guy, the way Jimmy heard it was, Binion goes to, like, the number two guy in L.A., who's Nick Licata, to say, you know, we got to get rid of this Russian Louis. And so Licata goes to Dragna and says, you know, we're going to get rid of the guy. And Dragna says, what's in it for us? And Licata goes back to Binion and says, what's in it for us? And Binion takes him right outside here, outside Binion's Horseshoe. There was an open lot across from Binion's Horseshoe. He says, I'm going to build a casino there. You get rid of Russian Louis, you guys get 25% of that casino.
Wow.
So he took that back. And Dragna says, yeah, let's do it. He said, but technically, you're never supposed to kill somebody for profit. It's supposed to be for business. And Dragna said, well, I did learn that Russian Louis was cheating our family members at card games.
Nah, there
so
we
that's
go.
Why we'll kill him. And we'll get the casino as a bonus. So Jimmy found out years later, he went to Binion and said, Benny, you know, I did the job on the guy. I got rid of the guy. How come I didn't get any money? And Binion said to him, what do you want? And Jimmy said, I want $60,000. So he says, okay. You know, they over a few days, they took some of the skim and gave it to Jimmy. Yeah. Then he said, oh, my other question is, how come we never got a casino? And he said, didn't Jack tell you? He said, I asked him about the casino later on. He just wanted cash up front.
No, really?
Yeah.
So not very much foresight there.
Yeah, he said Jack never told him about the cash he got up front. He should have given Jimmy some.
Yeah, he's, really?
Jimmy did all that dirty work, you know. Stuff that could get him the death penalty.
Yeah. Yeah, these mob guys, they screw over each other over all the time.
Yes, they do.
Can. They get by. I mean, think about it. If you're doing business with another criminal, think about it. You know, if you don't have some hold
over. Who are you going to call?
Yeah. Who are you going to call? Yeah.
You can't call the Clark County Sheriff and say,
I don't care how good a sheriff he is. You can't call him up.
No. So.
How squared away a police department is, you can't call the FBI. You can't call them up.
No.
Because you're going to be in it, too.
Exactly.
They're going to put you right down the tubes with them.
I'm kind of curious where Jimmy Fratiano is buried.
You couldn't find that?
I have to go to find a grave. I just didn't see it on the Wikipedia about him. I don't know if he was buried in Oklahoma.
Yeah, I don't know that either.
Interesting.
I think I read somewhere his body was cremated, so who knows? Maybe they scattered his ashes over Vegas or something crazy.
Yeah.
You know?
Send him back to Cleveland.
You know, most of those mob guys are these family-oriented people. And those grave sites are kind of important. You know, maybe they took him back to Cleveland where his family, his father was buried. I don't know. I see you guys are frantically on the computers there. Surely somebody's going to come up with a find a grave.
I don't know if his daughter's still alive.
Yeah.
His stepdaughter is. Gene's daughter is. Jimmy had a daughter named Joanne, who I think was born in 1938 or so.
Oh, yeah.
Does that sound right? 38.
She put about 80.
I'm trying to figure. Anyway, she could still be alive.
Yeah, she could be. Could have grandkids, too. She had children. Nobody's finding it.
She married the wrong guy. She married a guy that ended up giving
unknown.
Jimmy a bunch
I'll be
of,
darn.
She ended up giving... she married a guy who ran into the FBI and said things about Jimmy when Joanne and this guy, his name was Thomas, they got divorced.
Got two last names.
Yeah, he spilled the...
or two first names.
Yeah, Tommy Thomas.
Tommy Thomas.
Thomas. So he ran to the FBI after they got divorced and said all kinds of bad things about Jimmy. He ran to Look magazine. They had a series on organized crime, which ended up getting them in trouble. So that was the big source. Jimmy could tell this Thomas character was the source. But he got him in a lot of trouble because he lied about things, too. He lied about, that's what Jimmy says, he lied about me. Exaggerated.
Yeah. Interesting. All right, well, we can't find out where he's buried. I think we pretty well expended the topic of Jimmy Fratiano.
Yes.
He was a character. He was a character.
There's some great interviews with him on YouTube.
There's a ton of good interviews with him on YouTube if you guys want to go out.
Yeah, there are.
And see that.
Yeah, there's a lot of things he did I'm sure he didn't write about, too. There's not everything. There's some details in the book that I'm curious about. Like, when they hit the two Tonys, he opened the car door. Well, didn't he leave his fingerprints? And we were talking about that earlier, and yeah. We said, well, maybe he had a handkerchief in his hand so he didn't leave fingerprints on the door, but that would still be tricky to do.
Yeah, it would be.
You could leave your thumbprint, couldn't you, pretty easily?
Yeah, you could. The kind of part of the deal is how sophisticated were the people who took prints
right.
back then, and crime scenes back, a crime scene, can't think of the word for it, popular crime scene. Every policeman in L.A. that was on duty that night, they heard the word go out, oh, you got to come and see this. They all come flogging in. Even when I was a young policeman, we'd come flogging in and want to go see it. And the crime scene guys would be going, get out of here. Finally, they just started cordoning it off
yeah.
and coming out with a general order that said, you cannot come. Even the chief of police has to check in with the detective in charge before he crosses the crime scene tape. But that wasn't until the 70s that they did
yeah.
that. Back in those days, in the 50s, the newspaper reporters that were connected to the policemen, and you saw it in L.A. Confidential. You know, that newspaper guy was the one Danny DeVito played. It's kind of like a Walter Winchell kind of a newspaper reporter.
Yeah.
They were paying off cops all over the place in order to get the inside scoop and
the
get
QT
access
magazine,
to.
I think
yeah, what was the name of it?
QT.
QT magazine. Yeah.
Meet Tony Brancato and Anthony Trombino, two rising lieutenants in the Mickey Cohen rackets. With a dapper little gent in prison, who knows how far they'll go? The sky's the limit.
All right, I think we've expended this topic, don't you?
All right.
I think so. Well, maybe folks or fans, wiretappers, would like to know where they can find more information that Bob Custer might have. Are you online somewhere?
Sure. I'm on the Las Vegas Mafia history page.
Okay.
That's a good place to find me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Find that and follow that.
Absolutely. Larry Henry's in charge of that, so I write
stuff
for
right,
that.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And I put photographs on there, and some of their photographs I've taken of different crime scenes. For example, where the two Tonys murder happened on Ogden in Hollywood.
Okay.
And that looks virtually the same as it did in 1951.
Oh, I saw that. I remember. I saw that.
Yeah, I've even taken panoramas yeah. of it so you can see the view.
Yeah.
It's striking how close it looks to
it looks exactly the same as it did in 51.
So if you
close.
Ever want to do like yeah. a you know one of those recreation scenes,
yeah,
that
they
would be a good one.
They could absolutely there, especially with CGI now. It's yeah. it's pretty much the same.
You could Photoshop that murder scene photograph that they've got and put it right into the.
I mean, those murder scene
picture.
Photographs are incredible.
They are
I wish
incredible.
I could see all of them.
Yeah, they
and
are
I've
incredible.
Tried to see as many as I can find online, and there's got to be a lot more of them. But I give a lot of credit to those old news photographers because they had assignments, and I was a news photographer for a long time. They had assignments like Jimmy had been arrested for the two Tonys murders, and he had the photographer had an assignment from the editor, go out and photograph Fratiano's house in Encino.
Oh, really?
Here are the guys in the clink. You don't know if there's mob guys help watch his house or anything. The guy not only photographs the front of the house. He goes around and back. Jimmy's having a pool built, and he photographs the house from the back.
From the back.
And, you know, it'd take a lot of nerve to do that, I
yeah.
think, you know. But they were pretty nervy photographers.
Yeah.
Maybe he was, you know, that old had the kind of the newsman hat, and it said press on it.
Yeah.
Press. You
know? Press.
Yeah.
We used to have a guy like that in Kansas City in the 70s. He would show up everywhere. He'd sneak past police lines. He was bold.
Yeah.
Was Bill Norton.
Well, Bill Norton knew him. Bill didn't. He was a reporter, but this is a photographer, and he was a contemporary. Bill would remember the name. I can't remember the name now, but he would have done that.
He
would
have got pretty
over,
gutsy, I think.
He would slip through the other backyard, come up and back, and taking the picture.
So, in all fact, right. Even the courtroom photos, same thing. I think it would take a lot of nerve to walk up to a mob guy and say, not even ask permission, just start taking their photo.
I know when we talked with Bill Norton, who was a star reporter for 30-some years.
Yeah.
And he, when they let Nick Civella out when he was going to die from cancer, and he tells a story in an episode where we interview him and about how they flew him back up to Kansas City, and he's at the downtown airport, and you can't really ask him a question. They have a photographer takes a photo of him with these other people who are supporting him as he's coming down the corridor.
He needs help walking.
Yeah.
You know, so you're like, oh, hey, hold on, snap.
All these family members, this guy's up here snapping pictures.
Like, man, I would be, if I was one of those guys.
But it's easier
helping
now, too.
Nick.
And Larry Henry and I talked about this because cameras and everything are so much smaller now.
Yeah.
Remember the old press camera around the time of two Tonys?
3x5 or whatever. They were 4x5. Not 3x5, but 4x5.
And it's a big, bulky
cameras,
camera.
Yeah.
You can't just hide it.
Right.
Like now you could have a GoPro on or, you know, an iClass cam.
Snapping pictures like crazy.
Nobody knows really you're shooting. You know,
imagine but when back you're back then, in the 30s when they first came up with it, and you had to put the drape over you and you're like,
right. Well, that's the same kind of camera. You know, the drape thing is the folding apparatus in back. That's like the drape.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
They took great photos, though, didn't they?
Right. They did. Oh, they take great shots. Absolutely.
All right. If you have a problem with, or you have a friend, if you have a friend with problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900. Or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available on Amazon to purchase or rent. But you're going to want to purchase it because you're going to watch it over and over with the great detail that's there. And then you're going to want to know more about not just the Kansas City, but the skimming in Vegas. And so you're going to want to get Gary's book, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
It's a great read, but it's an even better listen because you're going to want to get the Kindle version of the book because it has hyperlinks to the actual audio with transcriptions from the mouth of the men that did it. And there's even more to know because the mob is all over. And in Kansas City, you might want to go to some of those places. And to do that, you want to get Gary's app, the Kansas City Mob Tour. For $1.99, you can take your own personalized turn-by-turn tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City.
And you want to go to the Facebook page, Las Vegas Mob History, right? Go to the Facebook page, Las Vegas Mafia History, and look for our friend Bill Custer's pictures and pieces that he puts up, because you'll learn a lot about Las Vegas mob history and Southern California mob history, Jimmy Fradiano, and everything else we've talked about today.
And remember to share, subscribe, and support Gangland Wire. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Good night, folks.
Music provided by our good friend and super fan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.